Listening test. Task 1. You were going to listen to Milena Velis from Labour Justice Radio talking about the need for internet access. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences, 1 to 9, with the sentence endings, A to L. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the spaces provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
More and more, having access to the internet is becoming a basic necessity for everyday life, like having gas, water, or electricity, something that every household needs in order to function. But more than a third of Philadelphia residents don't have internet access in their homes, and that divide falls largely along class and race lines. And at the same time that many households can't afford the bills for internet access or a computer, electricity is also set to become more expensive across Pennsylvania in the next year. These were the topics covered at an educational event organized by the Media Mobilizing Project earlier this month.
At least, like, every day we have about one class out of our 9 periods that we have to do work on the internet. And a lot of the classes, we were not able to get our homework unless we go on the internet to access the homework. The teachers post homework online, and if we don't go online and get it, we won't know what the homework is.
That was Alicia Stevens, who's a student at Bodine High School and a member of the Philadelphia Student Union. She spoke about how students had to fight in order to get the basic tools they needed to keep up with their schoolwork.
We found that, like, grades were dropping, then a lot of the students fall behind.
Philadelphia Student Union members did a survey of their school, and they found that they had only 4 working computers in the whole school for a total of 500 students to share.
And we went to our principal and told her that it was an issue for our students, that a lot of them need to do homework, and we're getting punished by our teachers for not doing homework but not having access to internet.
They organized a campaign to get more access in their school, and this year students have 10 working computers in the library, as well as access to laptops they can check out after school in order to do their homework.
And we found that if that campaign wasn't done, a lot of the students would still be dropping, and they can't just drop our grades like that without us being able to use internet in school.
Juliet Fink, who works with Philadelphia Fight, also spoke at the event.
Fight works with many people who struggle with many things aside from their HIV diagnosis. They struggle with intense poverty, often homelessness or unstable housing. They struggle with often mental illness, addiction, incarceration.
She gave another example of the importance of internet access for poor communities.
One of the things that in the early HIV and AIDS epidemic that happened was that people actually used the internet very, very early on to share information and learn about how to, like, find out new cures and latest drugs and information that was absolutely necessary for them to live.
But that work was useless if people couldn't access the internet.
And Fight provided that service up until about a year and a half ago, connecting over about 12,000 people in 15 years to the internet using dial-up access.
Philadelphia Fight is also one of several nonprofits in the region who are working on an initiative to expand broadband access in Philadelphia.
As technology advances, the infrastructure of society changes. And as people talk about the importance of the internet, you have to understand that as the middle class and the wealthy interests have internet, the structure of our society will change, and those people who do not have access will not have access to the infrastructure of society. In the same way now that if you don't have a phone, you can't call 911.
That was Lance Haver, who's been the consumer advocate for the city of Philadelphia since 2003. He spoke about the larger context behind some of these issues. Wages in the U.S. have not gone up since the 1970s, but the cost of basic necessities, from food to rent to energy, has been increasing steadily.
Because the more we are in debt, the less likely we are to quit our jobs, to go out on strike.
More and more, having access to the internet is becoming a basic necessity for everyday life, like having gas, water, or electricity, something that every household needs in order to function. But more than a third of Philadelphia residents don't have internet access in their homes, and that divide falls largely along class and race lines. And at the same time that many households can't afford the bills for internet access or a computer, electricity is also set to become more expensive across Pennsylvania in the next year. These were the topics covered at an educational event organized by the Media Mobilizing Project earlier this month.
At least, like, every day we have about one class out of our 9 periods that we have to do work on the internet. And a lot of the classes, we were not able to get our homework unless we go on the internet to access the homework. The teachers post homework online, and if we don't go online and get it, we won't know what the homework is.
That was Alicia Stevens, who's a student at Bodine High School and a member of the Philadelphia Student Union. She spoke about how students had to fight in order to get the basic tools they needed to keep up with their schoolwork.
We found that, like, grades were dropping, then a lot of the students fall behind.
Philadelphia Student Union members did a survey of their school, and they found that they had only 4 working computers in the whole school for a total of 500 students to share.
And we went to our principal and told her that it was an issue for our students, that a lot of them need to do homework, and we're getting punished by our teachers for not doing homework but not having access to internet.
They organized a campaign to get more access in their school, and this year students have 10 working computers in the library, as well as access to laptops they can check out after school in order to do their homework.
And we found that if that campaign wasn't done, a lot of the students would still be dropping, and they can't just drop our grades like that without us being able to use internet in school.
Juliet Fink, who works with Philadelphia Fight, also spoke at the event.
Fight works with many people who struggle with many things aside from their HIV diagnosis. They struggle with intense poverty, often homelessness or unstable housing. They struggle with often mental illness, addiction, incarceration.
She gave another example of the importance of internet access for poor communities.
One of the things that in the early HIV and AIDS epidemic that happened was that people actually activists used the internet very, very early on to share information and learn about how to, like, find out new cures and latest drugs and information that was absolutely necessary for them to live.
But that work was useless if people couldn't access the internet.
And Fight provided that service up until about a year and a half ago, connecting over about 12,000 people in 15 years to the internet using dial-up access.
Philadelphia Fight is also one of several nonprofits in the region who are working on an initiative to expand broadband access in Philadelphia.
As technology advances, the infrastructure of society changes. And as people talk about the importance of the internet, you have to understand that as the middle class and the wealthy interests have internet, the structure of our society will change, and those people who do not have access will not have access to the infrastructure of society. In the same way now that if you don't have a phone, you can't call 911.
That was Lance Haver, who's been the consumer advocate for the city of Philadelphia since 2003. He spoke about the larger context behind some of these issues. Wages in the U.S. have not gone up since the 1970s, but the cost of basic necessities, from food to rent to energy, has been increasing steadily.
Because the more we are in debt, the less likely we are to quit our jobs, to go out on strike.
Task 2. You are going to listen to an interview with a business expert about online shopping. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences, 10 to 16, with the sentence endings, A to J. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the spaces provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Now to that positive economic news that Larry just mentioned, holiday retail spending. According to Spending Pulse, which tracks retail sales, Americans spent about $584 billion in the 50 days leading up to Christmas.
That amount is not all in gifts. It does include things like gasoline and food, but it's an increase of 5.5% over the same period last year, and that is the biggest gain since 2005. Online sales saw an even bigger boost this holiday season with a 15.4% increase over last year. Diane Brady is senior editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, and she joins me now. Welcome once again.
Nice to be here.
And spending overall was up, but what exactly were people spending money on?
Well, we were spending a lot of it on clothes, certainly, and I think part of that goes to the self-gifting trend, where a good holiday sale should not just be lost on your loved ones. So I think that's a big area of spending. Computers, obviously, brands like Apple continue to gain. So basically all the things that people wanted under the tree, we were spending money on. But what's most interesting, I think, is to look at the trends where we're shopping online, because that is both heartening for people and I think troubling for a lot of retailers.
Well, first, when we hear of an increase that's about 15% online purchases, what does that translate to in terms of dollars?
Well, basically, online sales now make up about 6 to 7% of overall retail sales. So it's still a very small percentage of the pie. But the fact that it's growing so quickly, I think, is fascinating because there's a lot of trends behind it.
Well, let's imagine for a moment that it continues to grow, not too unlikely, and that over the next decade we see continued growth at this rate. What does that mean if we're doing a lot more shopping every year online as opposed to at brick and mortar outlets?
I think it shows a couple of things. One thing is how hard it is going to be to wean Americans, that is you and me, off our discount sales. Even myself, I went into Rockefeller Center this week. I pulled out my smartphone. There was a Lego sale. I noticed immediately that it was much cheaper on Amazon. People are going to be doing that more and more, standing in the stores and actually comparing prices. I think it also is something that may be troubling in terms of job growth, and especially when you look at commercial retail, basically. What's happened in the real estate sector, it suggests that perhaps this is still a country that is, quote, overstored. There are chances we're going to see more store closures as more Americans feel comfortable just doing a lot of their shopping by computer.
Because shopping online employs fewer people on the other end, and it requires less high-rent commercial retail space.
Exactly. And I think another thing you have to realize is it's a happier experience. When you look at survey after survey, consumers who shop online tend to report higher satisfaction levels. There's no lines. There are really no expectations of service. And very often now you walk into a store, it's hard to navigate, and there aren't a lot of people there to help you. So, you know, we're taking jobs away from the people who used to fold our sweaters for us and used to check out our goods.
Diane Brady, senior editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Now to that positive economic news that Larry just mentioned, holiday retail spending. According to Spending Pulse, which tracks retail sales, Americans spent about $584 billion in the 50 days leading up to Christmas.
That amount is not all in gifts. It does include things like gasoline and food, but it's an increase of 5.5% over the same period last year. And that is the biggest gain since 2005. Online sales saw an even bigger boost this holiday season with a 15.4% increase over last year. Diane Brady is senior editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, and she joins me now. Welcome once again.
Nice to be here.
And spending overall was up, but what exactly were people spending money on?
Well, we were spending a lot of it on clothes, certainly, and I think part of that goes to the self-gifting trend, where a good holiday sale should not just be lost on your loved ones. So I think that's a big area of spending. Computers, obviously, brands like Apple continue to gain. So basically all the things that people wanted under the tree, we were spending money on. But what's most interesting, I think, is to look at the trends where we're shopping online, because that is both heartening for people and I think troubling for a lot of retailers.
Well, first, when we hear of an increase that's about 15% online purchases, what does that translate to in terms of dollars?
Well, basically, online sales now make up about 6 to 7% of overall retail sales. So it's still a very small percentage of the pie. But the fact that it's growing so quickly, I think, is fascinating because there's a lot of trends behind it.
Well, let's imagine for a moment that it continues to grow, not too unlikely, and that over the next decade we see continued growth at this rate. What does that mean if we're doing a lot more shopping every year online as opposed to at brick and mortar outlets?
I think it shows a couple of things. One thing is how hard it is going to be to wean Americans, that is you and me, off our discount sales. Even myself, I went into Rockefeller Center this week. I pulled out my smartphone. There was a Lego sale. I noticed immediately that it was much cheaper on Amazon. People are going to be doing that more and more, standing in the stores and actually comparing prices. I think it also is something that may be troubling in terms of job growth, and especially when you look at commercial retail, basically. What's happened in the real estate sector, it suggests that perhaps this is still a country that is, quote, overstored. There are chances we're going to see more store closures as more Americans feel comfortable just doing a lot of their shopping by computer.
Because shopping online employs fewer people on the other end, and it requires less high-rent commercial retail space.
Exactly. And I think another thing you have to realize is it's a happier experience. When you look at survey after survey, consumers who shop online tend to report higher satisfaction levels. There's no lines. There are really no expectations of service. And very often now you walk into a store, it's hard to navigate, and there aren't a lot of people there to help you. So, you know, we're taking jobs away from the people who used to fold our sweaters for us and used to check out our goods.
Diane Brady, senior editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Task 3. You are going to listen to an interview with Gregory Dakishin, the creative director of Burton Snowboards, about how he was inspired to create a new kind of snowboard pants. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for questions 17 to 23. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
You may not be able to attack the side of a mountain like the snowboarder Shaun White, but you can at least attempt to look like the Olympic gold medalist. This fall, for $250, you'll be able to get a pair of the snowboard pants that he and the U.S. team wore at the Vancouver Olympics, the ones that you may have thought were ripped-up jeans. While the pants look like something pulled out of last week's laundry basket, they're actually very high-tech. They were designed by Gregory Dakishin, who's the creative director at Burton Snowboards, and he joins us now from Burlington, Vermont. Now, these were based on a real pair of jeans, is that right?
They were based actually on a pair of my own denim, one of my favorite pairs, and through a process called photosublimation, we were actually able to print them onto a very sort of high-tech Gore-Tex fabric.
So wait, how does this work? You take a picture of the fabric?
You actually take a picture of an actual full pair of denim, almost like a giant photograph, and then through a process of extreme heat, you actually print a photograph directly onto a pair of pants.
And the pants are made out of some sort of waterproof Gore-Tex material?
It's a polyester fabric that we print on with a Gore-Tex laminate on the back. That's correct.
Did they actually have pockets and a fly?
They did, yep. Completely. I mean, very authentic to denim, except for the fact that it was two-layer, guaranteed to keep you dry Gore-Tex technical fabric.
How long did it take?
I think we started the process almost 18 months ago. Coming into it, you know, it was a bit of a challenge. I wanted to do something that was really very American, but again, was very true to snowboarding and this idea of there's nothing more quintessential or iconic to American fashion is a great pair of jeans.
Why did Burton decide to manufacture more of these jeans and offer them to the public? It sounds like it's not a very easy process.
No, I mean, the sort of number of phone calls we received once the game started, I mean, I think for the most part, people at first probably thought they were just wearing vintage denim, and then when they found out it was actually a technical pant, I mean, I think they were very much intrigued and sort of, you know, the look of snowboarding right now is, you know, you always want something that I don't want to say, but your dad's not wearing. And this is sort of a look that very much doesn't look like it belongs on the hill. And I think it's something that's fresh. And we received hundreds of calls from consumers. And initially, we weren't planning on selling the pant, but being a rider-driven company, we really want to do things that our customers want us to do. And, you know, we decided to move forward with the pant and make it available to consumers.
And $250, that's the price point.
$250, that's right. And I think anyone that sort of gets them will be incredibly happy with not only the aesthetic of them, but the performance on them.
So what happened to that favored pair of jeans of yours that started this whole process?
They're still an essential part of my wardrobe. They're still in rotation, no doubt. Like I say, they tell a lot of stories. They're not going anywhere.
So you didn't have to cut them up or anything? You just took a picture?
No, I made very, very clear that that pair of jeans had to come back intact.
Well, Greg Dakishin, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thank you very much.
Greg Dakishin is the creative director at Burton Snowboards. He was talking to us from Burlington, Vermont. You may not be able to attack the side of a mountain like the snowboarder Shaun White, but you can at least attempt to look like the Olympic gold medalist. This fall, for $250, you'll be able to get a pair of the snowboard pants that he and the U.S. team wore at the Vancouver Olympics, the ones that you may have thought were ripped-up jeans. While the pants look like something pulled out of last week's laundry basket, they're actually very high-tech. They were designed by Gregory Dakishin, who's the creative director at Burton Snowboards, and he joins us now from Burlington, Vermont. Now, these were based on a real pair of jeans, is that right?
They were based actually on a pair of my own denim, one of my favorite pairs, and through a process called photosublimation, we were actually able to print them onto a very sort of high-tech Gore-Tex fabric.
So wait, how does this work? You take a picture of the fabric?
You actually take a picture of an actual full pair of denim, almost like a giant photograph, and then through a process of extreme heat, you actually print a photograph directly onto a pair of pants.
And the pants are made out of some sort of waterproof Gore-Tex material?
It's a polyester fabric that we print on with a Gore-Tex laminate on the back. That's correct.
Did they actually have pockets and a fly?
They did, yeah, completely. I mean, very authentic to denim, except for the fact that it was two-layer, guaranteed to keep you dry, Gore-Tex technical fabric.
How long did it take?
I think we started the process almost 18 months ago. Coming into it, you know, it was a bit of a challenge. I wanted to do something that was really very American, but again, was very true to snowboarding and this idea of there's nothing more quintessential or iconic to American fashion is a great pair of jeans.
Why did Burton decide to manufacture more of these jeans and offer them to the public? It sounds like it's not a very easy process.
No, I mean, the sort of number of phone calls we received once the game started, I mean, I think for the most part, people at first probably thought they were just wearing vintage denim. And then when they found out it was actual technical pant, I mean, I think they were very much intrigued and sort of, you know, the look of snowboarding right now is, you know, you always want something that, I don't want to say, but your dad's not wearing. And this is sort of a look that very much doesn't look like it belongs on the hill. And I think it's something that's fresh. And we just received hundreds of calls from consumers. And initially, we weren't planning on selling the pant, but being a rider-driven company, we really want to do things that our customers want us to do. And, you know, we decided to move forward with the pant and make it available to consumers.
And $250, that's the price point.
$250, that's right. And I think anyone that sort of gets them will be incredibly happy with not only the aesthetic of them, but the performance on them.
So what happened to that favored pair of jeans of yours that started this whole process?
They're still an essential part of my wardrobe. They're still in rotation, no doubt. Like I say, they tell a lot of stories. They're not going anywhere.
So you didn't have to cut them up or anything? You just took a picture?
No, I made very, very clear that that pair of jeans had to come back intact.
Well, Greg Dakishin, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thank you very much.
Greg Dakishin is the creative director at Burton Snowboards. He was talking to us from Burlington, Vermont.
Task 4. You are going to listen to an interview with President Obama's half-sister. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, complete the sentences 24 to 30 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
We've been hearing from Dr. Alma Obama, a well-respected mover and shaker on the world NGO stage. She works as technical advisor for CARE's Sports for Social Change initiative program and organizes projects
like this.
Well, Box Girls is one of the organizations that we work with. I'm always very careful about how I talk about these organizations because very often, because we're such a big international organization, it almost feels like we swallow them up when we talk about them because people assume that they're just a part of CARE or a project of CARE. Mm-hmm. But actually, these are small, local, non-government organizations and community-based organizations that partner with us. The organization is called Box Girls because they actually box. The girls use boxing as the sport, and this sport is used in this particular area because the founder, who is actually a man, who we call Priest, his name is Alfred Anyala, and he started this because the girls were very vulnerable in the area, being sexually harassed, and, you know, there was a lot of domestic violence. And he thought, if the girls can find a way to feel that they can defend themselves, even if they don't use force, if they can have that possibility, this will become less, the violence against girls. And it actually has been working. He works now with about 500 girls, and they go into the schools. We work with them together. We get funds so that they can do projects that we can then also support and that can also take forward our vision around girls and empowering girls. And what they do is they teach the girls to box. So the girls literally have boxing lessons, and they actually do professional boxing. So they learn it properly, and some of the girls now actually compete and represent Kenya abroad with boxing.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's amazing. Fantastic. And they have a very simple place where they do their training. And what I love best about it, which sounds really terrible, I'm sorry, but is that when they're training in this little hall, you have the windows, and the windows are plastered with boys and men watching, who you can see in their eyes that they want to participate. So they kind of like are all in awe of these girls, who are now called champs.
Wow.
When they walk around the neighborhood.
And if that's not empowering, I don't know what is.
Yeah. It is very powerful.
Well, we're talking about past, present. What about future? Any plans that you'd like to share?
Well, it actually depends. I tend to talk a lot about my work because that is really, really important for me. And also especially when I'm talking about myself in public, because that, I think, is what counts. And with regards to my work, what I really, really, for me, the important thing is to just get it right. Really, when I think about what I'm doing, I'm a bit ambitious in what I do. I'm very, very driven. And I really feel that if everybody kind of does a little bit towards making things better for each other, the world can become a better place. So I think my aspirations and the expectations and the goals I have are realistic. The question is just, can I do it? Hmm. And that is for me where my real wish for the future with regards to my work is that I get it right.
We've been hearing from Dr. Alma Obama, a well-respected mover and shaker on the world NGO stage. She works as technical advisor for CARE's Sports for Social Change initiative program and organizes projects like this.
Well, Box Girls is one of the organizations that we work with. I'm always very careful about how I talk about these organizations because very often, because we're such a big international organization, it almost feels like we swallow them up when we talk about them because people assume that they're just a part of CARE or a project of CARE. Mm-hmm. But actually, these are small, local, non-government organizations and community-based organizations that partner with us. The organization is called Box Girls because they actually box. The girls use boxing as the sport, and this sport is used in this particular area because the founder, who is actually a man, who we call Priest, his name is Alfred Anyala, and he started this because the girls were very vulnerable in the area, being sexually harassed, and, you know, there was a lot of domestic violence. And he thought, if the girls can find a way to feel that they can defend themselves, even if they don't use force, if they can have that possibility, this will become less, the violence against girls. And it actually has been working. He works now with about 500 girls, and they go into the schools. We work with them together. We get funds so that they can do projects that we can then also support and that can also take forward our vision around girls and empowering girls. And what they do is they teach the girls to box. So the girls literally have boxing lessons, and they actually do professional boxing. So they learn it properly, and some of the girls now actually compete and represent Kenya abroad with boxing.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's amazing. And they have a very simple place where they do their training. And what I love best about it, which sounds really terrible, I'm sorry, but is that when they're training in this little hall, you have the windows, and the windows are plastered with boys and men watching who you can see in their eyes that they want to participate. So they kind of like are all in awe of these girls who are now called champs when they walk around the neighborhood.
And if that's not empowering, I don't know what is.
No, it is very powerful.
Well, we were talking about past, present. What about future? Any plans that you'd like to share?
Well, it actually depends. I tend to talk a lot about my work because that is really, really important for me. And also especially when I'm talking about myself in public, because that, I think, is what counts. And with regards to my work, what I really, really, for me, the important thing is to just get it right, really. When I think about what I'm doing, I'm a bit ambitious in what I do. I'm very, very driven. And I really feel that if everybody kind of does a little bit towards making things better for each other, the world can become a better place. So I think my aspirations and the expectations and the goals I have are realistic. The question is just, can I do it? Mm-hmm. And that is for me where my real wish for the future with regards to my work is that I get it right.
This is the end of the listening test.